uncommon criminals. Not everyone who makes the headlines and draws big television ratings is a convicted murderer. Other big hits are convicted white-collar multimillionaires, like Martha Stewart and Michael Milken, the so-called King of Junk Bonds. So in high-profile cases are the families of both the accused and the victims. When there is a trial as sensational as that of O.J. Simpson, practically everyone involved is someone you want to talk with. Sometimes, too, the criminals turn out not to be criminals. That makes for particularly intriguing stuff. Let's start with a case in point, Patricia Hearst, the daughter of Randolph Hearst, chairman of the Hearst publishing empire. To this day, no one is really certain whether Patty Hearst was a criminal or a victim. 19-year-old Patty Hearst burst into the headlines in February 1974 when a homegrown armed revolutionary group called the Symbionese Liberation Army kidnapped her from the Berkeley townhouse she was sharing with her fiancé and stuffed her, in her nightgown, into the trunk of their car. A week later, the SLA released an audio tape on which she was heard pleading for her life. However chilling, that was to be expected. What was unexpected was the image caught on a security tape 2 months later of Patty at a bank robbery cradling a machine gun in her arms. "I am Tanya," Hearst said, using her new nom de guerre. "Up against the wall, motherfuckers." And so the rich, privileged heiress was transformed from being a sympathetic kidnap victim to an obscene, wanted felon. Hearst was finally captured in September 1975. Her trial, in the days before court TV, filled the newspapers day after day. Her defense tried but failed to cast her as a victim of brainwashing and intimidation. The jury found Hearst guilty of armed robbery, and she was sentenced to 7 years in prison. "I visited her there soon after I started at ABC. She wasn't allowed to give an interview, but I wanted to meet her in the hope she would give me one when she got out." Seeing her in federal prison was a surreal experience. Hearst had completed her reversion back to her pre-urban guerrilla days. Gone was her signature military beret, the dyed red hair, the cocky aggressiveness she had assumed with that machine gun in her arms. She was quiet and polite. Visiting her in prison led to my interview with her in 1981, the first she gave after her early release from prison. Hearst spent only 22 months in prison because President Jimmy Carter commuted her sentence to time served. Later, President Bill Clinton would grant her a full pardon. The country seemed to agree that it was the right thing to do. Our conversation was both chilling and puzzling. The chilling part included the 57 days she spent blindfolded and locked in a closet after she was kidnapped, the sex she was forced to have with the members of the SLA, their threats to kill her. The puzzling part was why, given many opportunities, she didn't escape or even phone home. At one point you found yourself in a motel in Las Vegas. You were alone, absolutely alone, for several days. You could have picked up the phone and called your parents just to say, "I'm okay." You never did. Why?
"I just couldn't," she answered. "It seems not only improbable, but it just seems so implausible. It never crossed my mind to call them. After everything they, the SLA, had done to me, my thinking was so twisted that I really believed that I could not go and turn myself in without being killed."
What I remember most from that interview was not what Patty Hearst said, but how dead-voiced she was. Here she was describing the horrific things that had happened to her in an expressionless monotone with no emotion. I was more emotional than she was. There were no tears, no guilt. It was as if the memories had been wiped out of her consciousness and she was reading from somebody else's text. Was that her way of coping? Had she gone through so much that any emotion was too much? I couldn't tell. What also stands out was her absolutely beautiful baby, Lydia. After her release from prison, Patty married a San Francisco policeman, Bernard Shaw, one of her bodyguards. They were living a quiet life then in a well-protected, unpretentious house in an upper-middle-class suburb of San Francisco. They are still married,
now have 2 grown daughters and live in Wilton, Connecticut. The last time I saw Patty was, of all places, at a polo match that Camilla Parker Bowles invited me to on the outskirts of London. Her future husband, Prince Charles, was playing. Patty was there with her beautiful, now grown daughter, the adorable baby I remembered so well. Lydia is a model, and Patty, for the most part, leads a quiet suburban life. She did not take her experience and say, "I'm going to spend my life doing something important." It's as if it never happened. Now, one of the most sensational stories I ever covered. In 1996 and throughout the next year, television viewers were glued to their sets to get the latest news about a beautiful blonde little 6-year-old girl named JonBenet Ramsey, who was murdered on Christmas Day in her family's Boulder, Colorado home. The tragic murder of the girl was even more lurid because there was so much footage of her parading around at child beauty contests, wearing lipstick, mascara, and suggestive adult clothing. The images sparked a national tut-tut about the child beauty contests and the adult sexuality they overlaid on JonBenet and her fellow prepubescent contestants. The discovery of her strangled body in the family's basement, her skull fractured and her neck bound with nylon cord twisted tight with a paintbrush handle, was horrifying. So was the blood in her underpants and on her Barbie nightgown. Was it a botched kidnapping? A ransom note was found on the stairs. Or was that a cover-up for the sexual molestation that ended in her violent death? And if so, who did it? Her parents were a respected couple named John and Patsy Ramsey, who by all accounts were loving parents. They insisted from the beginning that an intruder had entered their house, hid until they were asleep, and then hideously murdered their daughter. But accusatory fingers were immediately pointed at JonBenet's mother, Patsy, a former beauty queen herself, Miss West Virginia. Had she, the papers screeched, lost her temper after JonBenet wet her bed on Christmas Eve and in anger killed her? John Ramsey was also a target. Did he sexually assault and kill his daughter? Even JonBenet's 9-year-old brother, Burke, drew early attention, but was discounted as a suspect because the police believed he didn't have the strength. For months and then years, the focus was on JonBenet's parents. Grieving for the daughter they professed to adore, they also had to live with constant investigations and accusations of guilt of this most awful crime. It was only later disclosed that 38 registered sex offenders lived within 2 miles of the Ramseys. In 1998, 2 years after the murder, the case against John and Patsy Ramsey went before a grand jury. The jurors deliberated for 13 months. Their decision finally came down in October 1999. There was insufficient evidence to indict either one or both in JonBenet's murder. But the rumors and accusations continued. Even today, some think the Ramseys were guilty. Everyone, of course, wanted to interview them. I followed my usual route, writing letters and talking to them several times over the phone. I told them that they could finally let people see them when they were not looking harassed and cornered. They could calmly present their case. They had seen many of my past interviews and said they would think about it. Another year passed, and finally the Ramseys agreed to be interviewed. It often takes this long or longer to obtain an interview. The Ramseys didn't reveal any new information. They had none to give, but just listening to them was wrenching. "I saw her lying on the floor on a white blanket," John Ramsey said in a tight, tortured voice. "Her hands were tied above her head. She had tape over her mouth. Her eyes were closed. I immediately knelt down over her, felt her cheek, took the tape off her mouth. I tried to untie the cord that was around her arms. I couldn't get the knot untied." John Ramsey said he ran upstairs with his little girl's body, screaming. "It was like a dream, when you scream but you can't say anything." He said he laid JonBenet on the floor of the living room and Patsy Ramsey rushed in. Mrs. Ramsey, in anguish, then told me, I remember seeing her lying there in front of the Christmas tree, and I looked at John, and he said, "She's dead." It felt like my life was in slow motion, and that this was not really happening. I kept saying, "No, no, no," and I asked God to raise her. By the time we finished the hour-long interview, I was convinced, and am to this day, that they had not committed the murder. The Ramseys, it seemed to me, were still in extreme pain, devoted to each other and adoring of their daughter. They would have had to have been the greatest actors in the world to behave together as they did if one or both of them were guilty. You could see it in their body language, in the way John Ramsey consoled his wife at times during the interview. Most of all, neither had any record of violent or untoward behavior in their past, and there was no motive for killing a child they had treasured. You don't strangle a little girl because she wets her bed. Patsy Ramsey was also a survivor of stage 4 ovarian cancer. She seemed to be in remission, but she knew her cancer could return. At the end of our interview, she talked about her faith in God. "If it weren't for our faith, there would be no hope of ever seeing JonBenet again, but we know that we will see her again in heaven." I then quietly asked, "Do you think that JonBenet is in a better place?" Mrs. Ramsey answered, "I would have liked to think that my arms were the best place for JonBenet to be, but she's in a place where I hope to be one day. I know I will be there." The year 2006 marked the 10th anniversary of JonBenet's still unsolved death. Patsy Ramsey died of ovarian cancer in June of that year at the age of 49. 6 months later, I talked to John Ramsey once again. There seemed to have been a break in the case. A teacher named John Mark Carr had been arrested in Thailand after confessing to being with JonBenet when she died. "I didn't want to get my hopes up, even though it was easy to let that happen," Ramsey told me. The publicity surrounding Carr was enormous. Ironically, at some point I started feeling sorry for the guy because he was getting convicted, basically, as we were early on, Ramsey said. But no conviction ever took place. Carr was subsequently freed because his DNA didn't match any samples from the crime scene. Today, John Ramsey lives quietly in Atlanta, still hoping that the person who murdered his daughter and all but destroyed his and his wife's life will finally be apprehended. At the end of this last interview, I asked, as I had asked his wife, what faith meant to him. Here was his answer. "Because of my faith, I know the end of the story. I will be in heaven, and I know I will be reunited with Patsy and JonBenet. Finally, our story will have an end and a beginning." Murders are not the only stories that draw huge ratings. People also love to see the high and mighty fall from their halcyon heights and show up in police mugshots. One who took such a plunge from the top in 1989 was Michael Milken, a billionaire financier who was a highly controversial promoter of what were called junk bonds. Junk bonds are high-risk bonds that, because of their risk, could and often do pay very high dividends. In many cases, the junk bonds Milken advocated helped a lot of businesses, especially smaller ones, which otherwise might not have gotten off the ground. But Milken also made serious mistakes along the way in his zeal to promote the bonds and was charged with 98 counts of racketeering and fraud by none other than Rudy Giuliani, then a district attorney in New York. Milken was a huge name in the investment banking business, and he rapidly became the prototype for what were considered the excesses of the 80s. His photo was in the newspapers almost every day, looking gaunt and wearing a toupee. That fact didn't much help his image. The details of the major charges were extremely complicated, but they were sufficiently understood for a federal grand jury to indict him. After a plea bargain to 6 lesser securities violations, Milken was sentenced to 10 years in jail, a sentence that was later reduced to 2 years with 3 years probation. I knew and liked Michael Milken. He was a friend of my then-husband, Merv Adelson, and one of the companies he helped to finance was Lorimar, Merv's production company. Merv and I had spent time in Los Angeles with Milken and his wife, Lori, his high school sweetheart and mother of their three young children. He was brilliant, a visionary, and very much a family man. Though he was a billionaire, he had a relatively modest lifestyle. I remember having hamburgers at their rambling ranch house, which had been built for Clark Gable and Carol Lombard. The ketchup bottles were on the table, and we all used paper napkins. Those were early evenings. Milken got up at 3 a.m., so he could be in his office by 4, because it was already 7 a.m. on Wall Street in New York. That all came to a halt, obviously, when the court sent him to a minimum security work camp in Pleasanton, California, in 1991. I visited him there, as I had visited Patty Hearst in prison, in the hope of securing an exclusive interview with him when he was released. He said then that his biggest regret was letting the press define him. His lawyers had not permitted him to do any interviews. He felt that had he been allowed to, he could have explained what his motivations were and what good he had done. Lawyers, in their caution, often shut their clients up. I think it is a mistake. Too often they make their client look even more suspicious. If you have to go to prison, Pleasanton isn't the worst place to be. We sat outside on a bench in the warm sunshine. Milken was sharing a room with 7 other prisoners. They slept in double-decker beds. I noticed he was wearing a baseball cap, but not just to keep the sun out of his eyes. The prison didn't allow him to wear his toupee, so he was covering his head. "Why don't you take the cap off when you get out of here and get rid of the toupee?" I said to him. "Let people see you the way you are." Others must have told him the same thing, because when we did the interview in 1993, 3 months after he was released from prison, he was toupee-free. His homecoming, however, was clouded. Less than 2 months after his release, his doctor diagnosed him with advanced inoperable prostate cancer. He was told he had 12 to 18 months to live. I didn't dwell on the cancer in our interview. He called the news devastating, and we moved right on to his time in prison. Like Gene Harris, he had used it well. After a stint as a janitor, I cleaned toilets, washed windows, took out the trash. Milken was allowed to be an educational tutor. "Out of all the inmates I taught, only one did not get his high school diploma," he said. This was in keeping with the educational programs he had endowed through the Milken Family Foundation long before his indictment. One called Mike's Math Club attempted to make math fun for 5th and 6th graders. After his release, he expanded the program to include other subjects as part of the full-time public service he was required to do for 3 years with inner-city children. Even today, Milken is involved with education for children. At the time of our interview, Milken felt he had little time left to live. The challenge at hand was to beat his cancer, and against all odds, he did. He set up and funded the Prostate Cancer Foundation and a think tank he named Faster Cures. He completely changed his lifestyle and diet. The hamburgers we'd gobbled together were replaced with soy and vegetables. He became a devotee of Eastern medicine, yoga, aromatherapy, and meditation. Who knows what worked and what didn't, but to this day, more than 15 years later, Milken is not only alive, but well. I run into him from time to time and have sent several friends who have been diagnosed with prostate cancer to see or talk with him. He always gives generously of his time and knowledge. Milken took a dreaded experience in his life and turned it into a force for good. Martha Stewart also came out of prison, seemingly stronger and better for it. Stewart was the richest homemaker in America. She was worth more than $1 billion until she was indicted for securities fraud and obstructing justice in 2003. "Little Miss Perfect has fallen on her face," one reporter summed it up. And all, the government charged, to avoid $45,673 in stock market losses, which would have been petty change to her. I knew and liked Martha. I had decorated cookies with her for one of my specials in her perfectly appointed kitchen at her home in Westport, Connecticut. We had lunch afterward and compared our private lives, two divorced and ambitious women, each with a daughter. We became more or less friendly, not close, but friendly. When Martha was indicted, I called her lawyer, Robert Morvillo, to see if I could arrange an interview. Somewhat reluctantly, he agreed to meet with me, bringing with him several of Martha's other advisers. At that point, Martha Stewart may have been admired in some circles, but she was not liked. She was considered arrogant and cold. My argument at that meeting was that an interview would be an opportunity for her to show people another, more human side. I told them I would like to take Martha back to the small town in New Jersey where she grew up, so that viewers could see the warm and family-oriented life Martha came from, seeing her family home, her old high school, the library where she studied, would humanize her. Remember, I later did the same kind of visit with Hillary Clinton. Her advisors finally got the picture and agreed to the interview. The first part of the interview, which aired in November 2003, was the Martha at Home section. We went back with her to Nutley, New Jersey, to the house in which she grew up, with one bathroom for her parents and five siblings. I had to get up really early to use the bathroom, she said, which, in my mind at least, explained why she still gets up at 5 a.m. Her mother taught her how to cook, sew, iron, clean, mend, and tailor. Her father taught her gardening and, she said, everything else that had to do with keeping a home, like the plumbing, the electrical, the carpentry. She joined every single club in high school. Did you ever do nothing? I asked. I don't think so, she replied. Martha, as a child, was turning out to be every bit as formidable as Martha the adult. But at least you could understand her drive and her huge accomplishments. We did the rest of the interview on a chilly fall day in her house in East Hampton. I remember the kitchen being all different shades of green and thinking how Martha it looked. The dishes and napkins were green, even the floor was green. There was a fire in the entrance hall, and all was very cozy. But the major question in my interview was anything but comforting. Still, it had to be asked. Martha, at that time, was at the lowest ebb of her popularity. She knew it. Martha, why do so many people hate you? Her answer was straightforward. I think sometimes I may be insensitive, she said, but I have a job to do, and I may sometimes really think that others should work as hard as I work or concentrate as much as I concentrate. But those traits and that behavior, if applied to a man, would be admirable. Applied to a woman, you know, she's a bitch. Well, there was truth to that, God knows. Her indictment had, in fact, spawned much discussion as to whether she was being treated more harshly because she was a successful woman. Her many supporters started a Save Martha campaign on the internet, selling T-shirts, mugs, and the like. And indeed, if she was being punished for being more successful than most men, it was working. The value of the stock in her company had fallen sharply. I hear the figure you have lost is between 400 to 700 million, I said. Something like that, she said. The questions and her answers that made all the evening news broadcasts, however, were about the possibility of her going to prison. Her answer was the first time in the interview that she really got to me. She was then 62 and realized that her life was getting shorter. I sure could relate to that. The most painful thought to her, therefore, was the waste of time. At my age, there's no time for an unexpected, undesirable, unwanted hiatus, she said. When I asked her whether she was scared, she replied, "Of course I'm scared. Who wouldn't be scared? The last place I would ever want to go is to prison." She did, of course. 3 months after she had calmly folded those green napkins in the kitchen, she went on trial. I went to the court on the last day of testimony and thought her lawyer's summation was terrible. Morvillo was rambling and unconvincing. He also did not put Martha on the stand, which may have been a mistake. The prosecutor, on the other hand, made a compelling case with not too much actual evidence. On March 5, 2004, the jury found Martha guilty on all counts. She was sentenced to 5 months in prison, 5 months of home confinement, and 2 years of supervised probation. By this time, we were friends, and I went to visit her at Alderson Federal Prison in West Virginia. It was not unpleasant. You could take a walk outside, and there were tables to sit at. I'd brought a supply of quarters for the vending machine, and we sat outside eating yogurt. Martha had gotten the prison to put yogurt in the machines. She had adjusted well. She introduced me to her fellow inmates, all of whom seemed to like her. I wanted to do a new interview with her when she got out of jail in March 2005, but Martha was soon on to a whole new career at NBC. Producers had also visited her in prison and were convinced that she now had the sympathy of the country. They felt they could present a very different Martha, forceful, yes, but also warm. They arranged for her to do a version of Donald Trump's big success, The Apprentice, as well as a morning 5-day-a-week, 1-hour syndicated celebrity and cooking show, with a big, beautiful studio and a relaxed atmosphere for the new, fun-loving Martha. Unfortunately, The Apprentice, Martha Stewart, only lasted one season, but the daytime show is still on the air. The first season, NBC programmed it opposite The View in New York, the major market. We were worried about the competition, but it didn't damage us. Still, we were relieved when the Martha Stewart show was moved to 1 p.m. in New York. The View is on at 11 a.m. in New York. Now that our programs are no longer opposite each other and we are not competing, Martha and I are happy to be easy friends again. I think she is a terrific lady. She has radio shows, new magazines, all kinds of different projects. There is nothing this woman can't do. Unlike me, whose daughter once said, "My mommy can't cook, my mommy can't drive, my mommy can only do television." If we all think the Martha Stewart trial became a media sensation, nothing, no nothing, compared to the arrest of O.J. Simpson in June 1994 and his subsequent trial. I have saved this saga, the best, or rather, the worst, for last. Need I remind you that Simpson was tried for the murder of his ex-wife, Nicole Brown Simpson, and a young man of whom no one had previously heard, Ron Goldman. 95 million people watched the live pictures of Simpson's white Ford Bronco proceeding along an L.A. freeway, trailed by the police, on the day he failed to turn himself in. The slow-speed car chase occurred on a Friday, while I was on the air with 2020. Along with the rest of the country, we watched in fascination. Peter Jennings then joined us as the chase became more and more bizarre. Finally, after miles of being followed by the police, O.J. surrendered and spent the next 7 months in prison awaiting trial. My personal involvement began 2 months after the murder in August 1994. I was on vacation, cruising off the coast of Alaska on a friend's boat, when I got a call from my office in New York. "A Mr. Fred Goldman is trying to reach you," my assistant said. I thought hard, but couldn't place him. "The name sounds familiar," I said. "Who is Fred Goldman?" "We think he's Ron Goldman's father," was the reply. Good Lord. I jumped off the boat in the middle of nowhere, found an airport where I could charter a plane, and flew to Los Angeles, where I sat down with Fred Goldman, his wife, Patty, Ron's sister, Kim, and two step-siblings, Lauren and Michael. With all the emphasis on Nicole, the Goldmans were distraught, not just because their beloved son was dead, but because people knew nothing about him. The family wanted people to know that 25-year-old Ron was not just a waiter in a restaurant that Nicole Simpson frequented, but that he worked by day in a home for people with cerebral palsy and was working nights so he could eventually open his own restaurant. What was breaking their hearts was hearing Ron reduced to Nicole's male companion, or simply, a waiter. "I hear reporters talking about the victim, not victims," said Kim. "And I yell at the TV and scream out his name. Ron, his name is Ron. He has a name, he has a family, he had a life." This was the first of a series of interviews I did with the Goldmans. I was sad for Nicole and her family. But the more I got to know the Goldmans, the more I ached for them. Ron's father, Fred, had been divorced, and for many years, until he remarried, had raised Ron and his sister Kim as a single father. The whole family adored the easygoing Ron. They showed me home movies of him with his younger step-siblings, laughing, hugging them, singing with them, teaching them tennis. Ron was not part of the complicated relationship between Nicole and O.J. Simpson. He had simply been delivering the eyeglasses she'd left behind that night at the restaurant. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Kim and her stepmother, Patty, attended the Simpson trial every day. It was particularly difficult emotionally for Fred Goldman to attend that often. Kim, by her presence, became the conscience of the trial, reminding everyone of her murdered brother. To this day, whenever Kim or her father mentions O.J., they refer to him as the killer. I have stayed in contact with the Goldmans over the years. Fred and Patty moved out of Los Angeles and settled in Arizona. Kim wrote to me when she got married, when she had a baby, and later when she divorced. Among other things, she works for an organization that aids victims of crime, something she understands all too well. O.J.'s televised trial lasted 9 long months, from January to October 1995. The trial of the century, as it became known, was the greatest soap opera there ever was and turned millions of people into courtroom junkies. Even foreign leaders were transfixed. "Do you think O.J. did it?" was Boris Yeltsin's first question to Bill Clinton when the Russian president arrived in New York in October 1995 for a summit. You can imagine how intense the competition was among television journalists to interview anyone connected to Simpson and the trial. Of course, we all wanted to talk to O.J. himself. I got the home number of his personal assistant, Kathy Randa, and she arranged for Simpson to phone me at my home. His story back then is now familiar. Nicole was the villain. He had tried to break up with her, but she would keep coming back. He would never harm Nicole, the mother of his children. He laughed, strangely, during our conversation, but was charming and, I must admit, somewhat convincing. He didn't want to do an interview, but he wanted me to repeat our conversation on the air. I hung up, unsure whether this smooth-talking man was guilty or not. I did report on our conversation, but he never did agree to an interview with me or any other reporter. His super-skilled legal team saw to that. The Goldman family was talking almost exclusively to me. Nicole's family had become close to Diane Sawyer. We respected each other's territory. Everybody else was up for grabs, and it was a matter of phone calls, letters, contacts, the usual procedure. The trial made stars of many lawyers who flooded the airwaves, among them Cynthia McFadden, who did a superb job reporting for ABC, and a very smart ex-prosecutor named Star Jones, who would later come into my life on The View. I managed to secure interviews with many of the people who became household names and faces during the course of the trial, the most important being Brian Cato Kalin, the flaky blonde would-be actor who lived in Simpson's guest house and saw him the night of the murder. I interviewed Simpson's devoted assistant as well as his ex-wife, who swore that, during their 12-year marriage, Simpson never raised a hand to her. "O.J.'s a big talker," she said. "He likes to shoot off his mouth, but with little action. I'm here. I'm living evidence." I talked to Simpson's friend, a chiropractor, who spoke to Simpson the night of the murder and said he sounded fine and was a good guy. But then I talked to close friends of Nicole, who claimed Simpson stalked her after their divorce. "I'm so scared of O.J.," one friend claimed Nicole told her. "I'm so scared of O.J." For months, like the other reporters, I was caught in the whirlwind. The interviews everyone also wanted were with the legal teams in the courtroom. Marcia Clark, the dark-haired, now blonde, prosecutor who dressed in short skirts. Chris Darden, the young African-American assistant prosecutor. The members of Simpson's legal defense dream team, headed by Robert Shapiro and the now-deceased Johnny Cochran Jr., a brilliant and theatrical African-American lawyer. No reporter, and I include myself, went away on vacation. Finally, on October 3, 1995, after deliberating only 4 hours, the jury, composed of 9 African Americans, 1 Hispanic, and 2 Caucasians, reached a verdict. I was in L.A. and rushed to the hotel suite that we were using as a makeshift studio. I had arranged for Cato Kalin to be with me, and he almost fell off his chair in astonishment when the jury found Simpson innocent. Although he has never directly accused Simpson of lying, most of us feel that Kalin knew a lot more than he has ever expressed. If Cato was astounded by the verdict, so were millions of others. The verdict divided much of black and white America. In any event, O.J. Simpson left the courtroom that day a jubilant, free man. If Simpson was jubilant, one of O.J.'s leading lawyers, Robert Shapiro, was anything but. I got to him right after the trial and talked to him live for a headline-making interview. Rather than rejoice over the not-guilty verdict for his client, Shapiro was bitter at the way his colleague Johnny Cochran had used Simpson's race as a defense strategy. "My position was always the same, that race would not and could not be a part of this case," Shapiro told me. "I was wrong. Not only did we play the race card, we dealt it from the bottom of the deck." Shapiro was deeply offended, he said, by Cochran's summation to the jury comparing racism to the Holocaust. "To me, the Holocaust stands alone as the most horrible human event," said Shapiro. The race issue had become so divisive among the Dream Team that Shapiro said he would not work again on a case with Cochran. He believes that everything in America is related to race. I do not. An aside, Shapiro had, for the duration of the trial, basked in the fame that came with his being appointed one of Simpson's lawyers. At sporting events, he was often introduced and cheered by the fans. But the night of the Simpson verdict was also the first night of the most holy Jewish holiday, Yom Kippur. After talking with me, Shapiro, who is Jewish, went to his synagogue. He later told me that this was one of the most painful nights of his life. He was booed. The verdict continued to be a divisive issue between blacks and whites. No one illustrated that racial divide more than Chris Darden, who had been shunned and even threatened by blacks for prosecuting Simpson. When Darden sat down with me for his first interview, 5 months after the trial, he told me he agreed with Shapiro that it was Cochran who had inflamed the race issue. He'd already been marginalized in his old neighborhood for taking on the case. "Some people walk up to me and express pride in what I've done, and others, shock and outrage," he told me. The bar had been raised during the trial when Darden objected to Cochran using the N-word to illustrate the racism of one of the prosecution's witnesses. "It is the filthiest, dirtiest, nastiest word in the English language," Darden had protested. "It has no place in this case or in this courtroom. It will blind the jury to the truth." That gave Cochran the opportunity to discredit Darden to his own race. "His remarks are demeaning to African Americans as a group, and so I want to apologize to African Americans across the country," Cochran said. I asked Darden what he felt when he heard Cochran's apology on his behalf. "What he was really saying to African Americans was that I was a sellout. I was a race traitor. I was an Uncle Tom." Darden was devastated. "People wanted to kill me. People spit at me. Life changed for me drastically." When the jury found Simpson innocent, Darden told me he felt like he'd been struck in the stomach with a baseball bat. But he wasn't surprised. He said that his father, a retired welder, had warned him of the outcome at the start of the trial. "Black folks will never convict O.J. Simpson." Darden said he knew his father was right the moment he saw the jury. "From the first day, I didn't believe we had a snowball's chance in hell of convicting O.J. Simpson," he told me. "I sensed it was payback time and that we had no chance." A year or so after the trial, I also interviewed Marcia Clark, the lead prosecutor in the case. Her agents were predicting a big career for her, possibly on television. She, like Darden, had written a book that I found pedestrian, with no real insight. After reading it and interviewing her, I felt that she didn't have the brilliance of mind to have been the prosecutor at so dynamite a trial. Her future career has borne that out. Simpson may have beaten the murder charges, but he didn't beat the civil case brought against him by the Goldmans. In 1997, the jury found Simpson guilty of causing Ron's wrongful death and ordered him to pay some $8.5 million in compensatory damages. He hasn't. Fast forward to the summer of 2000. OJ had come up with a money-making scheme. He was launching a website that would charge internet visitors for him to answer their questions. He was looking for publicity for this new venture and wanted to come on The View. What ratings, I momentarily thought. But when I mentioned on the show that Simpson might possibly be on the program, the viewers and even our production staff protested. What was I thinking? We canceled OJ. Fast forward again to the summer of 2006. I was working on this book when I got a call from a representative of the ABC branch that produces special programs. My own specials are under the umbrella of ABC News, but rather than confuse you with the different departments, let me just tell you that the phone call was about another book, a sort of non-fiction piece of fiction called If I Did It. The book was purportedly by O.J. Simpson. Would I be interested in a 2-hour interview with him? If so, ABC would produce it. I was told I would shortly receive a chapter or two from the book, which was under a strict embargo. I read what was sent to me. O.J. described everything up to the actual stabbing. He said he had a friend who gave him a knife. It was chilling and filled with details I thought only the killer could know. But it was fiction, remember? And with the title, If I Did It, I felt there was no way Simpson was going to confess to the crime on television. ABC was not so sure. They wanted me to do the interview because they felt that only I could get Simpson to break down and confess. If I managed to do that, it would be sensational television. There would be huge ratings, and the case would finally reach closure. I was tempted, but it didn't take me long to make up my mind. Challenge or no challenge, confession or no confession, I couldn't have lived with myself if I were to give Simpson airtime to sell his book. I turned down the interview and ABC decided to drop the proposal. Fox later scheduled an interview with Simpson to be done by Judith Regan, the book's publisher. Rupert Murdoch owns both Fox and HarperCollins, where Regan had her imprint. A spate of angry editorials followed, decrying the deal. Fox withdrew its offer. Judith Regan was later fired. The saga continued in 2007 when a federal judge awarded the rights to the book to Ron Goldman's family to do whatever they wanted with. They published it under a new title, If I Did It, Confessions of the Killer, and it became an instant bestseller. As I write this chapter, OJ has been arrested yet again, this time for his involvement in an armed robbery in Las Vegas. I don't know what will happen to him, but I'm sure this will not be the last time we will hear from O.J. Simpson. As far as I'm concerned, however, it's the end of any interest I have in him or will have in the future. Unless he wants to sit down and really confess to murdering Nicole and Ron. In which case, I am ready. Over again, never again. Everyone should have a chance to be an interviewer. You get the opportunity to ask all the questions you would never have the nerve to ask in real life. It's a chance to get to know the most interesting, accomplished, and famous people in the world. I, of course, have had that blessed opportunity, although, believe me, not all of my interviews have been a success. There are a small number of people I have had great trouble interviewing over the years. There are others whom I have talked to again and again and never felt I could run out of questions, for they always had something new to say. I also think of the people I wish I'd interviewed, but either couldn't or didn't. First, the difficult ones. This doesn't mean I don't like or admire them, it just means that it's difficult to sit down with them in front of a camera. When conducting an extensive interview, it is necessary to talk on a personal level, at least to some degree. Otherwise, you are just plugging a movie or TV show. That's fine for a brief conversation, but not if you are trying to do something special. My problem in these interviews is that I wanted the person to reveal him or herself, if only a little bit, and my subject wanted to reveal little or nothing. So here are three of my bigger frustrations. Warren Beatty. Although he has much to say and is informed with very strong opinions, he is so obsessed with answering questions exactly the way he wants or thinks they should be answered that he is tongue-tied. And while I am talking about his mouth, it is like pulling teeth to get him to talk. The first time I interviewed Warren was my ghastly experience way back on the Today Show. Later, when I knew him better, he explained that he had just flown to New York from Los Angeles and had never done a television interview before. He said he must have fallen asleep during the interview, which was live. Well, thanks a lot. What I remember, and have already written about, is that I stopped asking him questions and went to a commercial. I have noted many times that it was the worst interview I ever did. Not long after, Warren more or less swore off doing any television, not just because of our interview, but because he didn't think his appearances particularly helped sell his movies. I remember when he made the film Reds, about an American communist buried in the Kremlin, I was told that he considered for a moment or two sitting down with me, but then decided not to. Then in 1990, he directed and starred in the film Dick Tracy, about the popular cartoon detective. There was a great deal of hoopla about the film. It had been 15 years since Warren had done a TV interview. But by this time we had been at several dinner parties, and he was warm and forthcoming, so I asked if he would finally like to sit down with me again. "Well," he said very slowly, then drew out the one word, "Yes." Bill Getty, who would produce the interview for a special, was thrilled. "Not so fast," I warned him, and our troubles began. It took weeks before we could get a date out of Warren, more weeks until he could decide where he wanted to meet, and days before he decided if and where he would like to place the police car that supposedly belonged to the fictional Dick Tracy. By the time we sat down to do the interview, I hated the damn police car. I hated the interview even more. Warren hemmed and hawed before answering any question. At that time, he had not yet married the divine Annette Bening and settled down to being a devoted husband and father. He was still known as a great ladies' man, and, in particular, a man who often had, shall we say, relationships with his leading ladies. In this case, Warren's leading lady was none other than Madonna. How could anyone do an interview with him without dealing with this? So I tried. Me. You have a history of falling in love with your leading ladies. Is it part of the excitement and the creativity of working, or do you work with someone to whom you are already attracted? I thought my question was broad enough so that Warren could answer it in any number of ways. Here is what he said. Warren. Well, as you know, I'm not going to answer that kind of question. I think as a journalist you should ask the question. And as a human being, I should decide what I talk about and what I don't, because I don't want to say the wrong thing. Me. What could you do to yourself that's the wrong thing? Warren. Well, I don't know. I just think you have to be prudent. Me. What could you do to yourself that would be so terrible if you opened up a little bit? Warren. Blake said, "Prudence is a rich, ugly old maid courted by incapacity." Here's another selection from that interview. Me. There are certain adjectives that one reads about you. Warren Beatty, recluse. Warren. Recluse? Me. Yeah. Warren. Here I am. Me. Okay, but you know, first interview in 15 years, so you are hardly outgoing. Warren. Well, said almost like a three-syllable word. I'm very slow. I'm very slow. Then Warren brought up that first and only other interview I had done with him. Did you think I was trying to give you a hard time? He asked. Me. I thought you were simply terrible. Warren. Do you remember that you cut me off in the middle of the interview? It was then that I realized that I was not doing well. But then, I don't think I said 5 or 6 words to you for the whole interview. Me. But you know, that interview had special meaning for me because when people would say, "What's the worst interview you ever did?" I would say, "Warren Beatty," and now I feel bad. Warren. Was there anybody up there alongside of me? Me. There wasn't even anybody close. You were it. Now history was repeating itself. This new interview with Warren was almost as bad as our first one. Not only that, but when it was over, Warren rose from his chair with a happy face and said, "Now that I've had a chance to relax, let's do the interview all over again." No, no, no. Let me say it plainly. I do not want to interview Warren Beatty again. But I certainly am glad we are friends. Mel Gibson. In 1990, I flew all the way to London just to interview Gibson for an Academy Awards special. He was playing Hamlet in a film directed by Franco Zeffirelli. And I give him a lot of credit for stretching himself and trying new things. I really looked forward to talking with him. We drove an hour to the Shepperton Studios outside London where he was filming. To accommodate him, we planned to do the interview right on the set. We arrived early in the afternoon and said we could talk whenever Gibson wanted. He was working hard, and we waited hours, during which I curled up on a bench and fell asleep. When he finally showed up at almost 11 p.m., Gibson looked as if he wanted to do the same. He wasn't rude, he just wasn't forthcoming. When I pointed out that a few years back he had received very bad press, he said, "Doing films back-to-back and not knowing how to cope with this new lifestyle or things that were expected of me, I was running into all these preconceptions from other people, so I changed my life and went back to Australia. I thought I'd exit for a while." I found that very honest and I understood, but the interview still had no passion, although in real life, Gibson is a passionate Catholic. Remember his remarkable film, The Passion of the Christ. Here is how our interview ended. Me. "Do you ever have trouble reconciling the violence, the sex outside of marriage, the nudity in some of your films, with your strict religious views and your own personal morality?" Gibson. "Hmm?" Me. "So what do you do?" Gibson. "I don't know." Me. "Did you ignore it? You do it anyway, obviously." Gibson. "I did it, so." Me. "Does it bother you, though?" Gibson. "No." So I decided enough of that and asked if he had any lines from Hamlet he would like to do for us. Here is what he said. "O most pernicious woman, O villain, villain, smiling, damned villain, that one may smile and smile and be a villain." I decided to think that was pretty funny, and I told him I would not take it personally. We flew home the next day. Did we become friends, as with Warren Beatty? We didn't even become acquaintances. Al Gore. First of all, let me say that I like and admire Al Gore a great deal, and perhaps one day we'll interview him again, even though he isn't a movie star. Although, in a way, he is one now, as a result of his Academy Award-winning documentary, An Inconvenient Truth. I'm including some thoughts about the former vice president in this chapter, because my last encounter with him was very discouraging. For 2 years after his devastating loss to George W. Bush, Gore did no television interviews. Then in November 2002, we heard that he and his wife, Tipper, had written a book. The publisher said that they wanted the Gores to do an interview. We assumed that the book would be something personal, so we arranged to do it, expecting to talk about the 2000 loss. However, when we got an advance copy, the book, titled Joined at the Heart, The Transformation of the American Family, turned out to profile the experiences of various families around the country. Almost nothing personal, and not a word about the controversial election, so controversial that it ended up in the Supreme Court. Our producer found the Gores' joint literary effort a well-meaning but tedious read, and asked me to explain to the vice president that it was not what we had in mind, that we'd like him to let us out of this commitment and that we would do an interview with him in the future. When I phoned Gore's people with this message, Gore himself got on the phone and was furious. I mean furious. He shouted at me, and I guess he should have. I had promised, he said, and I had to keep my word. The mild, bland Al Gore was nowhere to be heard. In a way, that pleased me. If I could somehow capture that passion on television, it would make for an important piece. So we agreed to go ahead with the interview, but we told Gore that he would have to talk about his cliffhanger loss to Bush. Okay. I went to Nashville, to the Gore's house, which looked rather like a miniature version of the White House. Before we sat down for the filming, Gore took me for a car ride. Along the way, he sang a bit for me, on the road again, and we stopped off at a local college, where he introduced himself to the students with the words, "I'm Al Gore. I used to be the next president of the United States of America." When I remarked that he was really quite funny, he thanked me and said, "I benefit from low expectations." So far, so good. When the interview began, the segment about the book was interesting enough. We'd also spoken on camera with one of the families featured in the book. But what everybody really wanted to hear was Gore's true reaction to the election. Well, forget it. That section of the interview in which we talked to Gore and Tipper, along with two of their four children, daughters Corinna and Kristen, was even more placid than the conversation about the book. Pleasant might be a better description than placid. Gore's answers to my questions conveyed no conviction, no introspection, no emotion. He should have had some kind of reaction to what had been such a traumatic defeat, but no. "My attitude," he said, "was that you win some, you lose some. Then there's this little-known third category. You flip a coin and it lands on its edge." A flip of the coin? No more, no less? In contrast, Kristen readily expressed her anger and disappointment. Of all the family members, she seemed the most bitter and the most real. But Gore kept repeating that all was and would be fine. He would find other things to do. No explanation, no regrets. Everything would be hunky-dory. Smile. I didn't believe a word of it. I have since been delighted to see the Al Gore I thought I knew reappear as he's taken on the task of educating us all to the dangers of global warming. I wish he had shown more of that passion when he was doing our interview, or, for that matter, when he was running for president. People often ask me whom I wish I could have interviewed or still want to. It's a small list, made all the more exclusive because, with the exception of one, they didn't or don't do interviews. They are the late Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, the late John Paul II, the present Pope Benedict XVI, Queen Elizabeth II, and the late Princess Diana. The Queen doesn't do interviews. Prince Philip occasionally will sit for questions, as he did with me in 1969, at President Nixon's urging, especially if they have to do with his favorite wildlife and environmental charities. Prince Charles, like his father, will occasionally also do an interview, if he is touting one of the many charitable projects in his Prince's Trust. I haven't talked to him since I interviewed him in Kensington Palace in December 1984. He told me then that so many people kept telling him how marvelous he was that he sometimes had to do a little self-kicking to keep from getting big-headed. He went on to have a rather disastrous interview in 1994 with British journalist Jonathan Dimbleby, in which he admitted he had been unfaithful to Diana, but only after the marriage had irretrievably broken down. He has not sat for an in-depth television interview since then. The big attraction to me, though, is not the prince, but his wife, Camilla Parker Bowles. We chose her as our most fascinating person of 2005, the year she married Prince Charles. We accomplished this with footage of her, but no interview. She obviously fascinated him. She still fascinates me. We had met several times, and once, as I've told you, she invited me to a polo match in England and was extremely gracious and easy to talk to. I have dangled the interview bait to her, saying we would talk about her favorite cause, the disease osteoporosis. So far, she has resisted the bait. Too bad. It is an important subject, and she could shed a lot of light on this debilitating disease. Talking about Camilla Parker Bowles brings me to the subject of Princess Diana. I sure wish I could have interviewed her, and almost did. Before I actually met her, I had been writing her representatives, requesting an interview or at least a meeting. Her press secretaries kept changing. The one constant employee seemed not to be her butler, Paul Burrell, who after she died claimed a very close relationship with the princess, but her private secretary, Patrick Jeffson. He had held the same position when she was married to Charles. The private secretary is extremely valuable to his royal charge. He is the person who, among other duties, helps to plan royal visits to other countries and then accompanies the royal personage. He often decides which events his charge should attend at home and abroad. He keeps the appointment book and helps decide who should or should not be invited to dinners. He is, in short, in many ways, the personal advisor and buffer. When Diana and Charles separated, it was decided that Jeffson should go with her, so he was the man I was most often contacting. When the princess made one of her first visits to America, he was with her, and we met and talked. He was very stiff upper lip in that very British way and extremely protective of his princess. However, we had a chance to chat and, as they say, we got on. After he and Princess Diana returned to England, he would from time to time ask my advice on an American charity event that was inviting the princess to attend. One such dinner involved the princess being asked to receive something called the Humanitarian of the Year Award from United Cerebral Palsy. I knew the charity very well because I had emceed past dinners and was to emcee this one too. I was involved because the chairman of the event was my old friend Jack Houseman. I checked and found that General Colin Powell was also going to be honored, and that if Princess Diana attended, Henry Kissinger had said he would present the award to her. I told Jeffson that the princess should absolutely accept, and she did. She looked dazzling in a clingy black gown, made a charming speech about compassion, and got a standing ovation. Another time Jeffson asked if I thought the princess should attend a certain fashion award dinner. I said I didn't think it was the best idea. She came anyway. She was criticized for being frivolous, but it did her no real harm. Anyway, little by little, Jeffson began to trust me, and so did the princess. At another large charity dinner in Washington, Diana was coming more and more often to America to raise money for breast cancer research. She and I sat one away from each other at the head table. I remember she was next to Ralph Lauren, who was chairing the dinner, and she danced the first dance with Oscar de la Renta. We had a chance to talk informally, and the princess, now divorced from her husband, teasingly asked if there were any eligible men in the room. I pointed out a few. "Too old," she said, "too short." I felt as if I were talking to my daughter. These different events brought us closer. Princess Diana sent me personal Christmas cards with photos of her and her sons and handwritten notes in her big round penmanship. I had another connection with the princess. One of her closest friends was a woman quite a bit older than she, named Lucia Flecha de Lima. Her husband, Paulo Tarso de Lima, had been Brazil's ambassador to Great Britain and now held the same post in the United States. Diana, who knew the couple from London, considered Lucia a surrogate mother and telephoned her constantly for advice. This was especially true when, after her divorce, Diana fell in love with a Pakistani cardiologist named Hasnat Khan and seriously considered marrying him. Lucia was very concerned and tried to advise Diana of the consequences. As we all know, Dr. Khan and Diana never married. She was not of his religion, and he, if not she, understood the potential consequences. He was also uncomfortable in the limelight. While this romance was going on, I was also quite friendly with Lucia, and we had many confidential conversations about the relationship, which at that time was little known. I never betrayed this confidence. I hoped Diana knew that, thinking it might make it easier for me to get the interview with her that I and every other journalist wanted. In 1995, I was visiting London and once more requested a meeting. The princess invited me to lunch at her home in Kensington Palace. This palace is actually a group of small townhouses connected to one another in a blocked-off area. On one side of Diana's house was the home of Princess Margaret, the Queen's sister. On the other side was the home of Prince and Princess Michael of Kent, the Queen's cousins. Diana was not particularly friendly with either of her neighbors. I arrived for lunch on time at 12:30 and walked up a flight of stairs to the living room. On the landing was a lovely portrait of the princess who was waiting at the landing. The living room was pale yellow. It was recently painted, she told me. As it happened, I was wearing a yellow suit. Diana laughed and said how thoughtful it was of me to match the room. This was a particularly trying time for her. She was separated from her husband, but not divorced. Her unhappiness, which manifested itself in various ways, including bulimia, had been written about in a blockbuster book by Andrew Morton. At first, Diana disavowed any participation in the book, but later it came out that she had been interviewed on tape for it. At our lunch, she said rather calmly that her husband and his family were trying to make it look as if she were mentally ill, so they could send her away somewhere. These accusations had been rumored in the British papers, but it was very disturbing to hear the princess claiming them over the chicken salad. I thought she was exaggerating, but she believed they were true. She was certainly not mentally ill, she said, but the accusations were wearing her down. She also complained about her brother, Charles Earl Spencer. She had needed a place to go in the summer, she told me, and had asked if she could take one of the houses on the family estate at Althorpe Park, where she was later to be buried. Her brother refused her request. There would be too many paparazzi, he said. She was angry and hurt. I remembered this when the Earl was giving his emotional speech at Diana's funeral and proclaiming his great devotion to his sister. I recounted what she had told me on the air after her death, and Earl Spencer was furious and threatened to sue. But it was true, and he knew it, so no suit followed. Before I left Diana on that now long-ago lunch, I asked once again if she would consider doing an interview with me, perhaps to explain how she felt at present and how she saw her life in the future. She didn't want to do one now, she told me, but when she was ready, which would be soon, I would be the first. I felt elated. She walked me down the stairs, not just to her entrance, but to my car, where she shook hands with my dazzled driver. It was such a simple but thoughtful gesture, the beautiful Princess of Wales walking outside her home to greet a driver she had never met. I could see why she was so beloved by so many of the so-called ordinary people. As soon as I got back to my hotel, I called my office in New York and said I might very well be doing an interview with the princess. A half hour later, they called back to say that news had just hit the wires. 2 days before my visit, the princess had evidently sat down to do an interview with a little-known BBC reporter named Martin Bashir. Martin, by the way, a fine journalist, now works for ABC in New York, and we are friends. But at the time, I was angry and extremely disappointed, to say the least. What I didn't know was that Martin, being of Pakistani birth, was a friend of Dr. Khan, and this gave him special entree to Diana, who trusted him. In a quiet, low-key way, he did a sensational job. This would be the bombshell interview in which the princess said there were three people in her marriage: herself, her husband, and Camilla Parker Bowles. This was also the interview that was said to have convinced the Queen that her son, the Prince of Wales, and Diana should get a divorce. One more thing, this interview was kept secret from her private secretary, Patrick Jeffson, and was one of the major reasons, he later told me, that he quit her household. After her death, Jeffson wrote an extremely revealing book that described his devotion, but also his frustrations in working for the princess. I did the first interview with him, but it hardly made up for never interviewing Diana. Once her interview with Bashir had aired in Great Britain, ABC bought it for broadcast here. I was assigned to introduce it. I wrote to Princess Diana and said how deeply moved I was by the interview and that I wished I had been able to do it myself. She wrote back a thank you note and said she hoped one day we still might do our interview. It never happened. The next time I reported on Princess Diana was at her funeral. Now, a group of people I could talk with again and again, each of whom I have interviewed at least twice. This list could actually be much longer, but to balance that small list of the impossible to get, I will keep it relatively short. Cher. She always has something new to say that is amusing, candid, and sometimes wonderfully outrageous. Over the years, in the course of several interviews, she has talked with me openly about her early struggle with reading and writing when she didn't know she was dyslexic, about her difficult marriage with Sonny Bono, who wanted to control her life, about her love affairs, why she likes men much younger than herself, her feelings about aging, she's against it, and almost any subject I wanted to bring up. She lives by her own standards and lets others live by theirs. Cher may change her costumes, her hair color, and even her attitude, but she is always the same delight to talk to. I think this goes for her onstage performances as well. My daughter, by the way, will travel many miles to see Cher perform. Bette Midler. I could say practically the same thing about Bette as I said about Cher, and I will travel many miles to see Bette perform. She can be hilariously funny and seriously touching. She is such a talent that when she sings Wind Beneath My Wings, it brings tears to my eyes. Watching her as Dolores del Lago, the bawdy mermaid in a wheelchair, I also get tears, but this time from laughing. Bette, in her stage act, sometimes tells dirty jokes, imitating the risque singer of the past, Sophie Tucker. Bette even named her only child Sophie. The whole performance has special meaning to me because, as I have said, Sophie Tucker appeared at the Latin Quarter as its star attraction year after year. I knew her well, and to this day can sing her theme song, Some of These Days. Bette has much more talent than Sophie Tucker, but she has the same delivery and love of a great joke, no matter how offensive. I also adore her humor about herself. I once asked her in an interview, on a scale of 1 to 10, how she would describe her looks. On a scale of 1 to 10, she said, "Oh, I think I'm about a 55. I think I'm a happening girl." She sure is. I have a special feeling about Michael Douglas and his beautiful wife, Catherine Zeta-Jones. It is not just that we three share the same birthday. It's more of a family thing. I've known Michael's father, Kirk, and his wife, Anne, for many years. Kirk is now in his 90s, and when he was in his 70s, he wrote a very honest memoir about his early life as a poor Jewish boy called The Ragman's Son. I did the first interview with Kirk when the book came out. I particularly remember it because it was during the time my mother's health was beginning to fail, and I was traveling back and forth from Los Angeles to New York. At the same time as I was interviewing Kirk, I was also talking on camera with Michael about his own hugely successful career. He was on one of my Academy Award specials. I have probably done at least 4 interviews with Michael. There was never a time when he wasn't thoughtful and candid. I interviewed him during a troubled period, when his first marriage was ending. Then I rejoiced when he married Catherine, and I interviewed them both. I consider them friends. Last summer, I attended a preview of Michael's latest movie, The King of California. He plays an aging man with a long beard. It is an extraordinary performance. I congratulated him, and he whispered in my ear, "When I look at myself in this movie, I see my father." "Yes," I said, "but you are a much better actor." "Forgive me, Kirk, but he is." Tom Hanks. He is the same off-camera as on. He is intelligent, unpretentious, and of course, a great talent. It is amazing to think that in our first interview back in 1989, he said he had fears of not making it. Tom had a difficult childhood. His father and mother divorced when he was 5, and Tom went with his father as he moved around the West Coast from job to job and from wife to wife. Yet he described his childhood as being as nice and normal as possible. "It was almost like being a celebrity, because when I was 10 and in yet another school, it was like, who is this kid? Frances, my dad's then wife, was Chinese. That was something that we really never thought about. It was a fact. But other people reacted amazed. But then, when you add up that she's also my third mother, and this is the 10th house that we've lived in, and I've been to 8 different schools, people would just sort of look at us and just shake their heads because they didn't know what made us tick. With that heritage, Tom should be one of the most neurotic actors around. But instead, he is a family man who has been married to the actress Rita Wilson since 1988. About his career, he said, "Hey, this is what I do, and it's not a big deal. I'm not a rocket scientist, and I don't have state secrets that I have to keep from everybody. I think they expect demons, some terrible thing, some drive, some bad side. Otherwise, how would I get to be in this position that I'm in now? Obviously, they think something very, very deep and some psychological thing makes them go off and do this as a job in the first place. And that's not really it." "So what is it?" I asked. "It's because it's fun," Tom answered. "And I think I'm pretty good at it. I deliver the goods, which is what a bricklayer does when he's hired to lay bricks, or take a mattress off the truck. He's paid to take the mattress off the truck. I take the mattress off the truck, and this is, wow, look at how that guy takes those mattresses off the truck." I asked, "What's the best thing that success this past year has given you?" "Probably a certain amount of confidence," he replied. "I feel as though I finished my master's now. I have that bachelor's, and now I guess it's time to go for the PhD. 2 Academy Awards later, Tom not only has his PhD, he could teach the course, but he doesn't. He remains a hard-working, happily married, funny, and very nice man.